It's a model that's proven in other markets to be more efficient and more effective and also can save lives.
Anchorage hospitals compete for the right to expand emergency services. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Good News Bay man shares a story of surviving in the open ocean after big seas swamped his boat.
And I was going straight up and down on the backside of the wave. And by the time I got to the bottom, there was another bigger wave that shot me straight underwater.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state will only allow a limited number of new emergency room beds in Anchorage in the next decade, and two big hospitals in the city are competing for the right to build them with very different visions for the best way to expand emergency care. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
On a busy day, the emergency department at Providence Hospital admits more than 200 patients. There aren't enough rooms, so some patients are in beds in hallways with curtains for privacy. Dr. Daniel Safranek, the department's medical director, says it's not ideal.
It makes the department feel crowded and a little bit chaotic.
Providence is asking the state to approve 14 more emergency room beds. 10 will be focused on pediatric emergency patients, freeing up other beds for adults. Because of crowding in its current ER, Providence says most of those new rooms could be filled as soon as they're built. But in Alaska, hospitals need approval from the state to build big new projects. The idea is to prevent hospitals from building too many facilities and then passing the cost on to consumers. The state has decided Anchorage can support 13 new emergency room beds between now and 2022. An Alaska Regional Hospital has its own vision of how to best use those beds. CEO Julie Taylor wants to build the first freestanding emergency departments in Alaska. One in South Anchorage and another in Eagle River.
It's a model that's proven in other markets to be more efficient and more effective and also can save lives.
Freestanding emergency departments offer a higher level of care than urgent care clinics. They operate 24 hours a day, are staffed with emergency medicine physicians, and are equipped with CAT scans and X-ray machines. Taylor says residents who live in outlying areas of Anchorage deserve quicker access to emergency care.
I think that we are at a disadvantage because all of the hospitals are located within a 2-mile radius of each other. So what if we had an earthquake and all of a sudden the roads were cut off? Everything is in one central area. So having emergency services available in the more remote locations obviously is better.
Because freestanding ERs aren't attached to a hospital, though, they don't allow quick access to specialists or surgery or blood transfusions. In the lower 48, they've been criticized for increasing inappropriate emergency room use and driving up the cost of care. Taylor says that is not Alaska Regional's intention. But Dr. Safranek at Providence Hospital is skeptical of the concept. He says many patients who visit freestanding ERs would be better served in an urgent care clinic. And he says in a true emergency, a patient is going to need to be transferred to a hospital anyway.
And more than likely, when you're transferred, you're going to end up in the emergency department of that hospital because that's where you can get services quickly. And so you end up delaying care for the sickest patients. So you're increasing the cost of care for many people, and the sickest people can't be cared for there. They have to go to the hospital.
Dr. Safranek doesn't think freestanding ERs deserve to be measured against traditional ER beds as Commissioner Valerie Davidson weighs her decision. But the state disagrees, and it will be up to the Office of Rate Review in the Division of Health and Social Services to make a recommendation to the commissioner. Executive Director Jared Cosen.
We'll look at what the trend patterns are for access, and we'll do our analysis, and ultimately it'll be up to the commissioner to listen to the public, look at the proposals, and make a decision.
Cosen says he expects Commissioner Davidson to issue a decision by the end of July. She could decide to split the ER beds between the two hospitals. A public hearing on the issue will be held next Monday, May 18th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the LUSAC Library. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Anchorage has cleared the way for Alaska's first large-scale marijuana convention this weekend, but not without strings attached. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, while the city's assembly voted to allow marijuana on site, it still can't be consumed.
The assembly voted unanimously to allow vendors to display marijuana at this weekend's Northwest Cannabis Classic Expo in the Denina Center. Corey Ray is with Pacific Sun West, the promotion company organizing the event, and says having actual plants and product is important for educating attendees.
To show people what clones are, to show people what a plant in harvest looks like. A lot of the demonstrations, a lot of the workshops, they actually have to have the flowers. So we've got trimming and manicuring workshops, and it's hard to sit there and trim and manicure a bud with no bud. You're effectively cutting space.
It's the biggest event for the burgeoning marijuana industry, held in a public building, and raised new questions and concerns for the municipality. Ray and his business partner bought an insurance policy for coverage, but until Monday's action, it was unclear to what degree marijuana would be present, if at all. Assemblymember Patrick Flynn pushed for a designated smoking area on the patio.
It's a little naive, I think, that we can't provide any venue whatsoever for consumption. And I'm trying to create a very narrowly crafted, personal use facility on the grounds that is private and out of sight of minors, and therefore appropriate.
But the rest of the assembly didn't agree, in part because of concerns raised by City Attorney Dennis Wheeler, who worries that vague statutes could open the municipality up to legal liability if something goes wrong.
I will remind the body that a gentleman fell to his death from the escalator, and one of the allegations is whether or not he was over-served, i.e. he over-consumed, and I really do not want to, at this point, early in the process of developing how we're going to regulate marijuana, to take on that risk.
A similar event scheduled for April in the Egan Center was canceled after the mayor's office banned displays of marijuana in buildings owned by the city. Ray says this weekend's Northwest Cannabis Classic is slated to bring more than $100,000 into the city. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Anchorage police say they consider the deaths of four people found inside a home in South Anchorage as suspicious. Police say a relative conducting a welfare check at the home today found the four people dead inside and called police about 12:30 p.m. Police spokeswoman Jennifer Castro tells KTUU the deaths appear suspicious, but wouldn't discuss the causes of death. She also would not say if the bodies were of adults, children, or a mix. Castro says the bodies have not yet been identified. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual fossil with an unusual story of discovery to go with it.
This is a real monster, and there's nothing alive like it today that has this crazy grouping of teeth that it keeps its whole life.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A 22-year-old man from Good News Bay was rescued Friday night after what may have been more than an hour alone in the open water. Rough seas swamped his skiff on a solo trip home from camping, and he says he's lucky to be alive. KDLG's Matt Martin has more on the story.
Ronald Johansson was camping out with his brother-in-law and cousin in Chugvon Bay last week. After some successful geese hunting, Johansson set out alone by skiff Friday afternoon to return home to Good News Bay. His cousin and brother-in-law were to follow in their own boat later. The trip should have been about an hour and a half ride back. The waters outside the sandbars were calm at first.
But then out of nowhere, the west wind hit the outgoing tide there, and it started making swells out there. And these were, 8 to 10 foot swells.
In his 14-foot skiff, Johansson took one of the waves head on.
And I was going straight up and down on the backside of the wave. And by the time I got to the bottom, there was another bigger wave that hit the bow of the boat and shot me straight underwater. The boat shot back out of the water and I was still holding on.
Johansson was wearing a life jacket, but he didn't think that would be enough. He grabbed a bundle of logs in the skiff, threw it overboard, and jumped in after it.
And as soon as I jumped overboard into the water and held onto the stump and the wood, I turned around, looked back, and another wave had happened to hit the skiff and did a barrel roll. So I jumped off just in time.
The 22-year-old says he was scared. Alone in the water, no one knew where he was, and passersby were unlikely. As he started to drift further towards open ocean, he began calling for help on his emergency radio.
20 minutes or so in of being in the water, my legs went numb, and then about 30 minutes, my arms went numb, and I tied myself to the log and told myself, put in my head that I will, that if I die, I'm going to die tied to this log so somebody could find me.
As his strength failed him, he panicked, and for a brief moment, Johansson started swimming away from his makeshift raft. Thoughts of family sent him back to the safety of the logs.
And during this whole time, there was a school of sea lions that were out there. So I was, 6 feet away from these sea lions that were just sitting there in the water watching me the whole time. And they didn't get close or anything. They just grunt around and they're watching me.
His radio calls were being received, but that didn't mean a rescue was guaranteed. Those back in the village notified boats, the Coast Guard, and others. Phone calls, text messages, and VHF traffic were flying out of Good News Bay Friday. The Coast Guard says one Good Samaritan vessel made an effort, but was turned back by rough conditions. Now, later in the evening, and unsure about rescue efforts, Johansson was trying to make himself as visible as possible.
Once I seen a big swell coming, as soon as I got to the top of the swell, I put my hand up and let go of the stump and pushed myself up with one log to try and reach my hand as high as I could.
Bethel-based Ute Air was among those notified of the situation and was able to direct pilot Ernie Turrentine to detour from his route and join the search. Turrentine says the big seas made for a tough search.
I kept thinking I saw a lot of stuff in the water because it was rough out there.
By air, Turrentine spotted the swamped boat and directed Johansson's brother-in-law and cousin towards that spot. But Johansson wasn't with the boat, and the tide was going out, so the pilot flew seaward, looking for Johansson and his bundle of logs. He didn't spot him, but Johansson's relatives on the water, given the swamped boat's location, soon did. They hauled Johansson out after what he thinks may have been an hour and a half in the cold, choppy water.
My wife and my kids and my family are the only things that made me hold on.
Johansson says elders told him the sea lions he saw had been there to protect him. He doesn't know if that's true or not, but he does believe he is lucky to be alive this week. He also believes it's a very good idea to wear a life jacket. Johansson has received reports his boat has now washed up on shore. He's hoping to get out there and recover what's left as soon as possible. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
State officials have rolled out their plan to terminate direct management of state parks in Sitka, including two of the most historic sites in Alaska. At a meeting of the Parks Citizens Advisory Board in Sitka yesterday morning, regional directors outlined their plan to find new management for the area parks, and if no one steps forward, to put the parks into so-called passive management. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
With the elimination of the position for park specialist, it's unclear who will be responsible for the care and keeping of Sitka's state parks, which is why Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation had to come up with a plan. It goes like this. Option one, develop requests for proposals, or RFPs.
Particularly for help at Point State Recreation Site, for a individual or business to submit to the state a proposal to operate the park and receive the revenues that are currently charged there for the picnic shelters.
Claire LeClaire is the division's operations manager. She says the state is also seeking new managers for Old Sitka, Castle Hill, and the boat launch. And if no one steps forward, there's option two.
If we're not able to attract viable proposals for particularly Howell at Point, but any of the other sites as well, then we're definitely going to look to other government agencies or nonprofits in the Sitka area.
And for those areas without takers, they will go into something called passive management.
Close the outhouses, so shutter them or board up the doors so people can't use them, because obviously if there's nobody there to maintain them, they're not really safe or sanitary for the public to use.
She stresses that the public will still be able to access the lands. Municipal Administrator Mark Gorman said the city has not been formally approached by the state to take over Halibut Point. When asked by KCAW whether the city would submit an RFP, Gorman said, "I don't think we have a mandate from the citizens to expand services in this area right now. If anything, they want City Hall to tighten its belt."
I think under the circumstances that we're going to try to do the best we can.
Board member Anne-Marie Lapalme was at the meeting and hopes that whatever the arrangement, it's temporary.
At some point, if funding does improve statewide, then we would hope that state parks would hire again to have someone locally to manage the parks.
The closure is written into the budget before the governor, which reduces funding for state parks by $500,000. Instead of spreading that cut evenly around the state, the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation proposed in March to end operations in Sitka and Valdez, and also eliminate one ranger position in the Wood Tikchik Park near Dillingham. If approved, these changes would go into effect July 1st of this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Most state ferries will sail their scheduled routes this summer. That means thousands of passengers will not need to be rebooked or sent refunds. But one ship will be shut down. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Craig Renkert and his wife Barb planned a 3-week tour of Southeast Alaska for this summer. They were looking forward to ferrying through the Inside Passage, celebrating the 4th of July in Sitka, and staying at bed and breakfasts along the way. Then, the couple from Ohio got some bad news.
When I got the email last Friday, I was very frustrated in that here they were at the last minute changing the ferry schedule, because many of those places I've made reservations have 60-day cancellation policies. Now the trip is less than 60 days away.
Renkert spoke with a reservations agent and was able to change his itinerary, though he's still juggling shoreside details. He'd heard of ferry breakdowns and spending cuts affecting the schedule, but the reservation agent didn't give a reason for the change.
Just because the budget wasn't planned further in advance seems to me to be utterly inconsiderate of the locals in the community, their businesses, and the tourists.
Legislative budget cuts were expected to deeply reduce sailings this summer, especially in Southeast. Officials estimated the cuts would cancel reservations already booked by about 10,000 people. But the Walker administration was able to shift $5.5 million in unused money from this year's fuel fund to next year's operating budget. Alaska Marine Highway spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says that allows other ferries to go ahead with scheduled service.
The only ship that will be reflected will be the Taku coming out. The other ships will be sailing as scheduled.
With the Taku out, sailings to and from Prince Rupert, British Columbia, will be cut from 4 to 2 a week. Those sailings also stop in Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, Cake, and Juneau. That will start in July. In the meantime, the Taku is filling in on routes of other ferries that needed extra time for repairs. Woodrow says the ship's time off will be used in part for work that's been delayed.
Every ship is required annually to have an overhaul, which is where we do an inspection to make sure it gets its recertification so it's safe for passenger service. So you have to do that annually. You can't push it back several months.
He says reservation staff are contacting those who book travel on the Taku beginning in July. While most of the summer schedule will remain intact, other reductions are likely come October, the start of the winter schedule. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
U.S. Forest Service officials are concerned about a stressed-out mama bear near the Mendenhall Glacier. John Neary, director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, says the sow is becoming more aggressive toward hikers, mountain bikers, and off-leash dogs.
She doesn't move off. She'll stand her ground on the trail. She'll even approach hikers, wanting them to move back away from her.
Neary says the black bear and her three cubs have been seen most often on the East Glacier Trail, which is closed temporarily to give the animals some space. He says the cubs are a little more than a year old and could strike off on their own soon. In 2013, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game tagged the mother bear, called Bear 103, by wildlife officials.
The radio collar data plus our own observations show her using much of this area, Dredge Lakes, the backside of the Steep Creek area, the Steep Creek Trail by the Meadows, the Trail of Time. She could be sighted anywhere along this zone.
He says the Forest Service will look at reopening the East Glacier Trail in about a week. Wood bison transplanted by the state to the western interior this spring appear to be adapting to the wild. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game flew a group of Canadian stock bison cows and young animals to the village of Shagaluk in March. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, most of the animals have fared well.
For the first time since wood bison went extinct in Alaska over a century ago, the big furry animals are back. The herd of 100 bison flown into Shagaluk and released into the surrounding Yukon and Innoko River country are being closely monitored by state biologists.
The bison took to being wild pretty quickly.
Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says that means breaking into smaller groups and spreading out, eating wild grasses, and giving birth to calves.
About 25 of the animals that we released were pregnant cows, and so far we've confirmed at least 6 calves.
Meanwhile, 14 other bison have died, including 9 that fell through rotting river ice in recent weeks. The animals were transplanted prior to calving as a way to anchor the species to the area, and Harms says some ice casualties were expected.
The animals that we moved had never really experienced ice, and the learning curve is very steep.
Harm says another 5 bison perished due to unknown causes.
We're real confident that predation didn't affect those 5 animals, and we have no evidence that there were any people anywhere near them. So we are still investigating those, but overall, losing 14 by this time is well within the range of success.
The state is preparing to move a group of full-grown bull bison to the Shagaluk area this summer.
They'll be trucked from Portage at the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center up to Nenana, loaded on barges, and it'll take about a week to get them down there.
Wood bison are the largest land mammals in the Western Hemisphere, and Harm says moving the 2,000-pound bulls may require anesthetizing or otherwise drugging the animals. The move is scheduled for later this month or early June, just prior to the summer breeding season. The wood bison reintroduction in the Shagaluk area is the culmination of a long-running effort to restore the animals to interior Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A unique fossil rock from Attigan Gorge is back in the state after a 29-year detour in Washington, D.C. The rock bears the imprint of teeth from an animal that has not been seen on Earth for about 250 million years. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the story behind the rock and its current status as a centerpiece of a Seward art exhibit is almost as fascinating as the prehistoric creature who imprinted it.
Scientists call it a helicoprion, but some call it a buzzsaw shark. That's because of the odd placement of teeth in the animal's lower jaw. They're in the middle of the animal's mouth in a single line, curved like the edge of a scimitar.
This is a real monster, and there's nothing alive like it today that, you know, has this crazy grouping of teeth that it keeps its whole life. But it was successful. It lived for 8 million years as a species.
That's Leif Tapanilla, an expert in the workings of the dental gear on animals that flourished millennia ago. The helicoprion may have gone extinct 250 million years ago, but one day in 1986, grad student Richard Glenn stumbled upon a strange rock on a mapping expedition to the Brooks Range.
I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know if it was important enough that it should be found, recorded, saved, preserved, or if you'd find more. So I left it up there on where I found it for a day, and then I went back up after my advisor came and told me that maybe I should go back and get it.
the young Glenn gave the rock to his instructor.
He'd never seen one before either, so he sent it away to one of his, to a paleontologist colleague of his, and that's how it got identified. And then it never came home.
It would be almost 30 years before Glenn saw his fossil find again. Enter artist Ray Troll, long known for his imaginative paintings of sea life, and it turns out, an ancient shark enthusiast. Troll and the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward have partnered on an art exhibit featuring Troll's depictions of ancient sharks. And in February of this year, Troll and Richard Glenn crossed paths at a Sea Life Center event. The subject of buzzsaw sharks came up, Troll says, and he heard about the fossil find.
I was pretty excited, though, that maybe I got to follow this up. It'd be so wonderful to have one from Alaska, actually, since this buzzsaw shark show was coming.
And that triggered a chain of events that brought the fossil home.
I knew a few folks back at the Smithsonian. I had met Dave Bahaska, the collections manager, before, and so I made a special plea with him to find it.
It took weeks, but finally a FedEx package showed up with the precious rock inside. Now gathered around a table, Glenn, Troll, and Tapanilla look lovingly at the centerpiece.
Yeah, it's a sparkly helicoprion.
There's a lot of minerals that are out.
Glenn, who now works for the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and Tapanilla with the University of Idaho, spoke Wednesday at a Geological Society of America meeting at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Troll joined them for a special presentation of the fossil rock, which now heads to Seward on loan until September. But Glenn says he'd like the rock to stay in Alaska.
My dream is to put it on a semi-permanent in nature that brings it as close to home as where I found it. And there's a nice museum just 40 or so miles west of where this was found that would be a great exhibit for rocks, fossils, and minerals of the Brooks Range.
So stay tuned.
In an October
see what
pass.
Happens.
Ray Troll's art exhibit, Buzzsaw Sharks of Long Ago, will be at the Alaska Sea Life Center through September 7th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matt Martin in Dillingham, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's promised tuition grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.